Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Trishul and Aaron look back at what happened with GameStop and use this crazy, quixotic story to examine different aspects of trading equities. They explain shorting stocks, margin calls, and the impact of large trading volumes. They then highlight how hedge funds, Wall Street Bets, and Robinhood created a whirlwind of chaos, with GameStop caught in the middle. In the end, they uncover a fascinating intersection between classic stock market irrationality and modern technology. And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
Great to be here as well. Today, we're going to be talking about GameStop and Reddit, Wall Street Bets, and short squeezes. And you might be thinking to yourself, wait, didn't that happen a while ago? Isn't that done with? And that really is the point of Trishul's and my conversation today, is just the kind of personalities that we have and the fact that we're financial planners and we're not day traders. Like, when this was happening, all we did was kind of laugh and kind of what's going on and kind of enjoy the hilarity, because neither of us actually participated. But now that it's kind of over, like, I don't want to say this, I don't want to like make a promise that you can't keep kind of thing, but now that this feels over, we want to kind of look back and try to understand what happened and where kind of our understanding of trading and the financial industry comes into play. And not necessarily do things that happen again, but kind of if we understand kind of the impacts, at least we can make some observations to be looking out for in the future. So I think we need to start with just understanding shorting. So Trishul, do you mind starting us off with just it's not even like intro to investing. This is like next level of investing, of placing short trades, which is the opposite of long trades.
Yeah, happy to, Aaron. So shorting is certainly pivotal to this whole conversation around GameStop. So it definitely makes sense to just have some sort of idea of what's going on with shorting and how it plays into this larger story. And quite simply, shorting is just a trade that's placed that hopes to profit if the price of a security goes down. So imagine IBM is always going to be trading at 100. I've been saying that for, I think, 2 decades now. Does IBM still exist even? I don't know.
But I will check while you discuss shorting. It's actually at 121 right now.
Okay. Well, for better or worse, that seems to hold for generation after generation.
Yes.
So
IBM's trading at 100.
Let's say IBM's trading at 100 and you're not too happy about IBM and its future prospects and you think it might go down. Well, you can apply this short trade so that if IBM goes down 20% to 80, that you would earn 20%. And that's how a short position would work. It would make your position go up in value if the price of IBM falls in value. And at a high level, that's how it works, but the mechanics are a little more nuanced in terms of how that actually gets pulled off in a market. The way it gets pulled off is you have to actually borrow those shares from somebody who has them. So Aaron, if you have IBM and you're long those shares, well, I would borrow them from you and I'd say, hey, Aaron, can I have them for a little bit? I want to, you know, use them for something, and I'd take them from you. I'd pay you a little bit of interest, Aaron. I'll pay you $2 this month to hold them for the next month. And I'd immediately sell those shares, and I'd get $100 in my pocket. Now, that's great. I have $100, but Aaron's going to be like, well, I need my shares back at some point. And what could happen is two things. Let's say a month later, the shares of that position of IBM went to 80. Well, I'm quite happy because I can take my $100 and I can take 80 of that and I can buy the shares in the market. And now I have this one share and I paid $80 for it. And I can say, hey, Aaron, here you go. Here's your share. And I can kind of, you know, wash my hands away. I paid $2 in interest, but I made $20 because I have $20 extra. So I made an $18 profit or 18% profit. So that's roughly how short selling goes in terms of you have to borrow the shares and then you have to return them after you close out the position. Now, it worked out in this case because the price went down to 80. But if the price went up to 20 or went up $20 to 120, well, a few things can happen here. One, I may realize that I'm at a loss right now. And here's that how that would happen. If I don't want to lose any more money, well, I would still have to buy back these shares at 120. I only had, in theory, $100 from Aaron. So now I got to put $20 more. I'm gonna. It's a little more complicated than this, but I'll add the next level. Okay, so now I have to spend $120 and put an extra 20 of my own money. I get the share and I return it to Aaron. But what that means is I just spend an extra $20 that I didn't have, meaning I'm down 20%. Roughly, that's how it works. Before I get into how margins fit into all of this, so far, so good, Aaron.
Okay, so we take out kind of classic investing idea of buy low, sell high, but instead we're just reversing the order of selling high before we buy low. We're selling before we're buying, and we still want to buy low, sell high, or sell high, buy low. That's still how we make money on this trade, but we're changing the timing of the sells and the buys.
Yeah, and you can imagine that there's a little bit of concern if a stock price goes up a lot, because I would have to spend a good amount of money potentially to buy back a stock. And what if I don't have that money? Meaning, what if IBM went from 100 to 200? Now I got to search around for somewhere for $100. And Aaron's going to get a little concerned if the stock goes to 300, because he knows I only have $100 to my name. At that point, here's where the concept of margin comes into place. So margin is basically a cushion that I have to hold on to with my broker so that I can safely have enough money to buy the stock back in from the market and repay it and give it back to Aaron if I need to. And what the margin requirement for a short position is 50% above the price of the stock. So the bank that's or the broker that is that's making this transaction happen would require me to have $150, 50% plus the $100 that I already received from selling that stock that I borrowed from Aaron in my account. So I have this $150, and what that means is if the stock price goes up, you know, to 20 or to 120, well, I still have enough to cover. But you can see how if it goes up too much, then I'll get something called a margin call. And what that margin call will say is my broker will say, hey, Aaron's getting worried here. The stock's gone up a lot. You're going to have to put in some more cushion in case the stock goes up even more. And that's how this notion of margins kind of plays into this whole conversation as well.
Okay. So the margin would be a little bit like that, the loan to value of your house. If you buy a house with a 20% down payment and 80% mortgage, but you want to refinance, the refinance company might require to have a 70% loan to value. You have to have like more equity in there as a cushion for that. And in this case, because stocks are more volatile than home prices, it goes all the way down to 50%. You have to kind of maintain a 50% equity in your account. And if the stock price goes against you too much, they'll either force you to kind of close it out or put more money in. So they always want to make sure you have at least enough equity in there that if there's more cushion, if it goes against you more, there's still more cushion.
Yeah, that's right. For example, when you buy a stock, typically if you buy with a cash trade, well, let's say I bought, or Aaron, when you went and bought IBM initially, 2 decades ago for $100. Well, at that point, you may have taken, you know, $100 from your bank account, put it in your brokerage account, and bought that one share for $100.
Man, better be yielding a great dividend if I'm going to have no stock price appreciation for 2 decades.
Right.
Okay. So I bought $100. I spent my own money to buy $100 stock.
Yeah. And nobody's worried about that particular trade, because if the stock price goes down, well, that's just Aaron's money that gets lost. It can go down to, in fact, zero. Aaron, you can lose all your money. Everybody can kind of wash their hands and move on. There's no big issue there. But Aaron, you could have bought that stock on margin as well. You could have borrowed some money, put a little bit of money down, and the bank would have kind of filled in the rest. And your cushion, your equity, could have been a smaller percentage than that $100. But if the stock starts going against you, meaning going down, well, then you'll have to increase that cushion to cover any other losses.
Good old leverage. The I'm borrowing to buy more, amplifying my return, both up and down.
Right. Yeah. And you can see how this can be tricky, because when you're short a stock, or sorry, when you're long a stock, the most you can lose is it goes to zero. It can go down from $100 to zero. But when you're short a stock, the most you can lose in theory is,
it'd be infinite, I guess.
Infinite.
If the stock price can always go up, then your loss can always get worse and worse.
Yeah, like imagine you shorted GameStop at $5, which is around what it was trading, you know, not too long ago, like a year or so ago, and it jumps up to $400, which is what it did. Well, at that point, for every position that you hold, you're going to owe a ton of money. Now, most likely,
there's something like, I don't know, negative 8,000%.
Something like that. Yeah, so that's why shorting it can be quite risky from some perspective. And that's why there's this whole notion of margin, because we don't want to end up in a position where I'm owing Aaron billions of dollars because I went short some stock. Hopefully my broker who is handling this transaction will kind of slack my account on the back of the head and close out my position and just cut the losses before they get too severe. And that's why the margin calls are there.
Okay. So I think if you are borrowing shares, if you're shorting shares, you have to do a margin. And there is that borrowing component. And brokers use margin calls to always maintain that cushion, so that as the stock goes up and up and kind of your position is losing more and more, the person who loaned the shares isn't kind of losing their actual shares. They'll eventually get their shares back, and the broker is acting as that enforcement vehicle.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So I do know kind of with GameStop, there was a hedge fund that was shorting GameStop. And so kind of do you mind going into, I believe they were shorting more shares than were trading. I believe that's called the short float. I'm going to ask you the short percentage of the float. I'm going to ask you to explain that a little bit more. But there's a Reddit thread or a subreddit called Wall Street Bets, WSB, if you see this. And one of the more observant participants in that thread noticed that GameStop happened to have this particularly large short position. And so they were using kind of social media and the subreddit thread themselves to see if they can get enough people buying, they can benefit from. So there's a few factors that we'll have to kind of get into, of like just market dynamics a little bit, and the difference between fundamental value of a company and market behavior. you might hear people kind of talk how if there's more buyers than sellers, the price will go up. If there's more sellers than buyers, price goes down. And that's kind of true, but it's not exactly the way it works. But very roughly, for a purpose of our conversation, if you have more people buying, that will be more likely to drive the price up. And if you have more people selling, that will be more likely to drive the price down. An example of this might be, let's say a CEO of a company needs to sell some of their company stock to pay a very large tax bill or buy a third house. Okay. Probably they have to get approvals for this, but just the idea that if they're trying to sell a few million shares of this stock and the kind of normal trading volume just isn't that high, the fact that they're trying to sell a few million shares, that order itself is large enough to start driving the price down, because the market, the brokers and the exchanges will try and find buyers for that one seller. So if they're trying to sell a million shares, okay, I found a buyer for your first 100,000 shares and they sell 100,000 shares, but the next buyer wants to buy at a lower price because they know that trade is out there and outstanding. And so as this trade gets filled, it will kind of drive the price down as trying to find buyers, they'll come in at lower and lower prices. And that's the idea is like, if you're selling more than there's people looking to buy, that can drive the price down. But if there's more people buying and willing to pay slightly higher prices at each step and keep buying, that can drive the price up. And so Wall Street Bets tried to use this idea of a lot of people placing more and more buy orders to drive the price up. And also part of that is that because there was that short position that was unusually large, they knew that the hedge fund would eventually have to buy back those shares. And so that the hedge fund itself also buying shares could drive that price up a little bit more and more. And so I'm kind of asking you, kind of, can you try to explain outstanding shares, short percentage, and just that concept of more people buying is driving the price up away from any kind of company fundamentals?
Yeah, happy to dig into that a little bit more. It's an interesting confluence of events that kind of led to the scenario we saw, and definitely insightful to kind of parse it apart a little bit. At a high level, yeah, when you borrow a share, you got to find it. So in this case, I found yours, Aaron. But there's a regulation out there where if I can't find yours, or if I wanted to short IBM, I would have to have my broker go out and find it for me so that I can borrow that share. And there are regulations in place by the SEC saying that if you're going to be shorting, those shares have to be located. You can't just naked short a position and short something without finding the borrower first. Now, that there are a few small edge cases where you can be naked short. If you're a market maker, meaning you're not speculating, but you're just adding liquidity into the market, this is something that's allowed by the SEC, but you're not supposed to be naked short for a position if you're just speculating, if you're like a hedge fund. So that might be part of the concerns that were going on here. At a high level, again, if you're shorting, the standard procedure is you ask your broker, can I borrow the share? The broker will say a few things. One, brokers maintain these lists called, what are they called? Easy to borrow lists, meaning every night they figure out how many shares there are that they can easily borrow, and they come up with, okay, we have 10,000 of these, 50,000 of these, and so on. And roughly, there should be enough to handle small requests here and there from clients if it's dispersed and it's kind of expected in terms of average borrowing that generally occurs on a day-to-day basis. So typically the broker will say, yeah, this is on my easy to borrow list. You can go ahead and place a position. No worries. I'll find those shares and I'll take care of it. And typically a stock may have a couple percentage points short, maybe 4 or 5% of the shares are borrowed and then sold short. And in that case, the market moves along smoothly. However, there can be some situations where a lot of short interests, meaning the percent of share shorts, starts to crop up. It goes from maybe 5% to 15% to 20% to 30%. And in the frenzy of what was going on with GameStop, it actually appeared to go over 100%, which is something that's not ideal, not supposed to happen. And the concern at that point is, well, it could be possible that there were naked shorts in place. Now, what used to happen...
If it's over 100%, almost by definition, there have to be naked shorts, where there's more people who have short... There's more shares that have been shorted than shares outstanding in the market to be borrowed and shorted.
Yeah, and specifically, there could be more than what would be sensible for just the market makers who are technically allowed to have naked shorts because they're just providing liquidity. So there could be more than 100% speculative shorts as well, which is something that's frankly not allowed unless there's certain edge cases.
Yeah.
So that in terms of just overlapping of times and the timing and things like that. So, for example, you have 3 days to locate those shares and get them by settlement. So there could be some overlap during this period where shares are being shuffled around and, mathematically, things are not where they should be.
Yeah, settlements is going to come up later.
It is. So a few things. The SEC did realize that this is a concern and that perhaps these naked shorts were contributing to harmful downward pressure of stock prices, and they tried to enact legislation to help curb this, and they did. They added legislation. Part of what they added was the SHO, Reg SHO in 2005, but I think there's been shore ups to this regulation over the years, and it's kind of been this cat and mouse game of trying to get more stability and provide more regulation, and then hopefully that's enough, but realizing it may not be enough and so on. So frankly, I don't know if we found the full solution to this, and maybe there'll be changes kind of put into place based upon what happened with GameStop. But essentially, shorting is sensible if it's at a level that is kind of under control. But when things become unhinged, you can get a lot of crazy situations like what we've seen with GameStop.
Okay, so one thing that's coming to mind is it sounds like the hedge funds shorting GameStop, because they kept shorting and they kind of increased that short percentage, that implies they're placing more and more sell orders. And so it sounds like they're trying to use their own shorts to drive and the more and more selling to drive the price down, which would then make their short positions, especially at the beginning, profitable.
Yeah. And so in theory, that's not nice and it's not allowed, which is where this whole cat and mouse game kind of comes up. For example, if you're shorting a stock for the specific purpose of creating a movement such that the stock price falls and you do certain things to encourage that behavior, then that could be seen as troublesome and in the light of the SEC. I don't want to speak too much on the specifics of where that gray area begins and ends, because frankly, I think it is a pretty gray area. So there is some concern that you can overstep your bounds by doing that. I can't say if it's clear at this point. If those hedge funds, this was Melvin Capital, for example, that's been drawn to light, overstepped those bounds. But maybe what's even more important to realize is the fact that, yes, if you are shorting, it might put downward pressure on the stock. That's not sensible. But the flip side to that is, yes, as what Wall Street Bets ended up doing in terms of buying the stock, that push pressure on those short positions, because Aaron, as you mentioned, as the stock price started going up because of that buying pressure, it caused margin calls on the behalf of the hedge funds, meaning they had to pony up more money. it got to the point where the hedge funds were losing billions of dollars because they had to keep putting up more money to keep these margin calls open. Or those positions were closed out by their brokers because they didn't have enough money for the margin requirement.
By closed out, case, you mean the broker forced them to sell?
Because
that's part of the margin agreement.
Sell, meaning that the hedge funds had to buy those shares to have their short position or those borrowed shares returned. Well, if you're buying shares, you're kind of working against yourself, as you mentioned, Eric. And so it's this kind of vicious cycle of, oh no, you got this margin call, you got to go buy some shares now to close it out. Well, if you go buy shares, you're going to pump up the price and you're going to hurt yourself even more if you have remaining shares. And that's kind of what happened with this notion with GameStop, where you saw the price shooting up because of a short squeeze, where you had a compounding effect of the Wall Street Bet people purchasing the shares and then the short positions being unwound, meaning those people that were short had to also buy shares, thus further pushing up the price, causing more margin calls. And then it just kind of turns into mayhem.
So hedge funds were trying to short and then sell more to try and... I noticed you avoided using the phrase market manipulation, and I kind of agree with that, because they could just be taking on more and more risk. This is a legal investing strategy kind of thing. And I agree that we're avoiding that phrase, but it did go against them. And so kind of as more and more buyers came in, that was driving the price up. And then as the shorts had to be closed out and the kind of sales were forced upon them, that also continued to drive the price up. I'm almost kind of surprised we've gone this far into the conversation without bringing up Robinhood, because I think this is now where a new character enters the story.
Yeah, the saga continues.
And this is actually something that we've discussed in the past. It is, I don't think this strategy would have been available even 5 years ago, in a big part because trades had commissions on them, or had at least some costs. I think even in the day where E-Trade could have a $5 trade or a $7 trade, I don't know that this would have happened, because there's this kind of, the hedge fund money was a few players with lots of money, and so they're placing really, really large trades, but so kind of only one trade. And so they have commissions that are kind of understandable. And that's kind of become the Goliath in the story. And Reddit and Wall Street Bets, and with the help of social media, it took a lot of smaller investors kind of all applying the same strategy, but they're placing much smaller trades. And so I think it was the fact that Robinhood allows for commission-free trading is an important part. And you've talked about in the past, I do kind of agree, that the commissions themselves are one of those kind of costs that will eventually, it's one of those kind of commoditized costs that will eventually go to zero based on technology. And we kind of saw that happen. And in general, I kind of agree with that sentiment, that things that can be commoditized will eventually, the cost will be driven down to zero based on technology. But is this one of those kind of edge cases of maybe trading shouldn't be completely free? And I don't want to necessarily get into that conversation yet. Maybe that's a conversation for a different day. But it is an important component that Robinhood allows for commission-free trading. I believe they also allow for partial shares. The idea was that you could rebalance your ETF portfolio. That's kind of the main intent, where you didn't have either the platform fees or the expensive costs. You could kind of do it yourself. And if you wanted to buy some stocks as well, you could put together your own portfolio with fractional shares. And so you get the same asset allocations as large hedge funds and institutional investors, and you can apply some of this kind of same stock strategy, but you don't have to have hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy enough shares of each stock to have a well-diversified portfolio, you could do it with smaller amounts. And so that's why they call it kind of democratization of investing. They're really trying to design the strategies for smaller investors, but it allowed a lot of smaller investors to place a lot of trades in one particular stock. In this case, it was GameStop. And so there was, I think, one day where the trading volume, the kind of number of shares bought and sold in that single day, was greater than the number of shares outstanding, which implied that people were owning GameStop for an average of 90 minutes that day. That all of the Redditors and following Wall Street Bets were buying and then selling about 90 minutes later as the price kept going up dramatically, which kind of kept working because there's more and more people coming in to keep buying at those higher and higher prices. But I think that it's important to kind of understand that Robinhood offering the commission-free trading was an important component that allowed this to happen that may not have happened even 5 years ago. So not even just the social media component, but like the technology has gotten really good, really fast. And we found an edge case for maybe this is not the perfect ideal.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuances to this saga, and it's interesting how Robinhood plays into it. At a high level, one thing to think about is, well, what is the value of GameStop even worth? And how does even one come up with a sensible price for it? And we talked about this way back in terms of how do investors in general figure out what the price of a security should be? And one of the founding techniques we mentioned is this notion of fundamental analysis, or something that's driven in terms of value-based investing. And the notion is, well, what you can do is you can analyze the financials of a business and project its earnings and cash flows and then figure out, okay, based upon all that, I added it all up and I discounted everything and the present value of IBM should be $80. Well, it's trading at 100 and that's why I would short, because hopefully the price will go to what value I think it should be. This is known as the intrinsic value of the business versus the market value, which is the price of the stock that's currently trading in the market today. Now, if there is a differential there, meaning if the intrinsic value ends up being 120, well, then I would buy IBM. If it's trading at 100, and again, if it's less than 100, then I would short. However, here's kind of what we saw with GameStop. We saw that maybe 5-6 years ago, it was trading in the 30s, and it's been declining ever since because a lot of people realized that, oh, I can buy my game online from Amazon. I don't need to go to the store. In fact, the new consoles, you just click on a button and it downloads the game automatically. So at the same time, a lot of people are just not going to malls like they used to. So having an outlet store to deliver an electronically deliverable good seemed like a poor play, and it's been reflected in GameStop because they started earning less money, their revenues have been going down for a long period of time, and the stock price fell from 30 in about 2016 to before the pandemic, let's say the summer of 2019, it was trading around $5, $6. Now, what happened at that point is a lot of short positions were also continuing to understand that, hey, the future of GameStop doesn't look so good. And that continued to put downward pressure on the stock. Well, of course, it doesn't help that you have a pandemic where people can't even go to GameStop anymore. It's certainly not a service that's necessary for our survival in terms of groceries or healthcare and gasoline and things like that. So that put even more downward pressure on the price. And we saw some really low numbers coming for the valuation. It dropped to like $4 or even less, close to, in the last 52 weeks, less than $2.60. So here's a company that's been terribly beaten down, and maybe for good reason, but at the same time, there became these large short positions which got picked up on by Wall Street bets. And then the saga continued to kind of drive up the price from, you know, $5 to $10 to $20 to $30 and $100 and $200. And it peaked out at about $480. So all of this is not reflected in how well this business is doing at all, because nothing much has changed in terms of the prospects. Maybe a vaccine is more likely on the horizon, but that's kind of been well known. But at the end of the day, it's hard to say that this should be one of the most expensive companies out there at $400, meaning the value of that business shouldn't be on par with the largest companies out there today.
I think that's really important to kind of note that if we were to try to apply any kind of fundamental analysis, like, it almost makes sense what the hedge funds were doing. Their earnings were down, their value was low, but it probably was going lower just based on the pandemic. So like, if you're trying to apply any kind of normal fundamental stock analysis, any form you wanted, then that was an acceptable risk kind of thing. And the Robinhood allowed kind of enough buyers and kind of it's like a pooling effect of enough money coming in where the actual trading activity and what was going on had nothing to do with any kind of fundamental analysis. And this is a little bit where kind of Reddit and social media come in as well, is that you saw people coming in and buying literally just to buy. They're not looking at company fundamentals, not looking at the like, oh, will my, will this, I'm now a part owner of this company. I think it's doing well. I think it'll make more money. There were some people back at the beginning, back at when it was around $5, like, you know what, this is actually a low enough price. I think we can make some changes and I think they can probably move up from here. But with social media and the ability for Robinhood to allow you to open an account with basically no minimum, no commission, and buy as many or as few shares as you wanted, you saw people buying just to kind of participate in the buy. And I remember, like, that's when you and I were kind of just laughing of this, like, there's no way to apply any kind of normal analysis. Could we even apply any kind of abnormal analysis? Is there any way to figure out what's going on? Because it's in the moment, we could also kind of see there's no way this lasts. There's no way, it might go on a few days, maybe a few weeks, but there's no way this lasts. And I feel like the people who are buying in know that, enough of them have to understand they're buying in at an extraordinarily high price, knowing that it's going to crash, but I guess they're hoping to get out before it does. And it's like, I couldn't figure out I could kind of understand what their thought process was. So I've seen it play out other ways, but it's just, it was more funny than anything else. Like, I'm just chuckling and watching what was going on.
Yeah. In terms of being a spectator, it's just kind of crazy. The madness that kind of bubbled up from all perspectives. And it's interesting to also note that this was a ton of money that was being circulated around. At one point I saw, I think it was like $70 billion. And on that day, as you mentioned, you had volume that was more than the trade of the shares. So $70 billion was just swirling around and people were buying and selling in terms of a frenzy for something where, as you mentioned, that there's zero commissions, there's the ability to get in and out with just one share and hope that somebody else is willing to pay more. I think that there's two reasons from my perspective that somebody would have made this trade. One is the kind of screw Wall Street mentality where, okay, let's do something fun and take down some hedge funds. Maybe I can understand that because, yeah, you know, why not put $100 in and you can join the fun of kind of sticking it to some big funds. I think that might be part of it. And yeah, the second part of it kind of aligns with what we had mentioned with the Bitcoin episode of the greater fool theory. And this is a valid investment strategy that many people have employed in the past. And the notion is simply, it doesn't matter what the intrinsic value is, if something is overvalued or undervalued, it just matters that if I buy something, that there's going to be a greater fool behind me who's going to pay more. So that's kind of the premise behind that particular investment strategy. And the notion is, yeah, if you believe that there's somebody out there who's going to read that paper and finally jump on the FOMO bandwagon of GameStop tomorrow, well, then yeah, then I'll make that trade for today.
I think that's a really good point. I almost wonder, kind of thinking back to our Bitcoin conversation, if the fact that Bitcoin is just a little harder to get into, it's not impossible. And I think anyone can figure it out. You can buy fractional shares. But it's just Robinhood made it so easy to open an account, transfer money, place a trade with so little money. Like, I wonder how much of that is coming into effect. And then the GameStop just happens to be the random stock that someone on Reddit found, where like Bitcoin could like easily have the same effects if it was as easy to open an account as Robinhood. And I don't know if I'm like, I don't have a Robinhood account, but this might be like free advertising for them kind of thing. Of they make it so easy for anyone, I'm almost worried, is do they make it too easy? But maybe in our society, no.
Well, in act three of this saga, so Robinhood actually ended up putting severe limits on trading of GameStop. They made it to the point where I think at one point you could only trade one share at a time, something like that.
I know that they had also said you could sell your shares of GameStop, but you could not buy any new shares.
Yeah, so they put their own restrictions, which may have frankly put a halt to the madness that was going on, but it also caused the price potentially of this security of GameStop to kind of top out and not continue to climb, because people lost their ability to trade it at the level they were before they put these controls into place. The other thing I'll mention, which is, I don't want to keep my tinfoil hat on too closely, but one thing to realize with Robinhood is, and frankly, a lot of brokers, how do they make money if they're charging $0 for trades at this point? Well, the reason these companies, these brokerage firms can make money by charging $0 for trade is they're selling the actual order information to hedge funds. Hedge funds use that order information to figure out what to do and what to buy. So it's known as order flow. It's allowed. You can sell this information. You can buy it. It's publicly available if you capture this data. But the notion is, it kind of goes back to the notion of, well, if you're watching TV for free, and you're not paying for it, well, how is the TV company making money? Well, they're selling you ads. They're making up that money somehow. And, you know, if you have your free Gmail account, how is Gmail making money? Well, they're selling your data. Well, that's kind of what's happening with these brokers. They're selling your transaction data, and they're using that to make more money. So it's not a free lunch. And in fact, if you're working on, if you're using the Robinhood app to place trades, you're not the customer, you're the product. You're the person who's being used to make money off of.
That's a good point. I think we need to kind of keep that in mind. So it's almost, as a tech company, sounds like they're great. As a financial company, they are normal. But I think their PR needs a lot of work. Because I think the big stop and why they kind of stopped trading actually gets back to the settlement issue that you had mentioned a while ago. The idea that, and I don't think that Robinhood is the broker providing the shares to short. It's not from that perspective. I believe this the hedge funds had a different broker. it was the idea that when a trade is placed, a kind of going back to when the stock markets were created, a price was agreed upon, and the participants of the brokers, they had a kind of a few days to settle the trade. That, okay, we need to actually get together, exchange cash for stock certificates. And eventually it's, you know, like, okay, cash from one financial institution got transferred to another, but it, there was always this settlement period for trading. So while a price had been agreed upon and we're using brokers and exchanges to make sure that the money actually gets transferred, there was always the settlement period that allowed shorting to work, where like, okay, I can provide the shares to short because I'll find the shares in the next 3 days. I don't know if settlement is still 3 days for shorting. Most stock trades are now down to settlement of 2 days just because of technology. But there's still this idea that when a price is agreed upon, and that's usually just the clicking the buy and sell, and kind of they make the trade, you don't actually receive the cash in your account for a couple of days later. Now, because financial institutions can kind of use statistics and they can kind of provide liquidity, they will most of the time they'll say, okay, you sold this stock, even though we don't technically have the cash from the buyer yet, we have enough reason to assume that we will get the cash and will allow you to make a new trade in that account with the proceeds of what you just sold. And the idea is that they're kind of letting you take advantage of the liquidity, even though they haven't actually received the money based on that trade. With Robinhood and GameStop, it actually started to get too many trades and too much of the kind of company of Robinhood kind of allowing you to place trades with your proceeds, even though they hadn't received the cash. And this now gets into the way trades clear. And there's different financial intermediaries and clearinghouses that say, okay, even though you haven't received the, even though Robin hasn't received the cash from the other side of the trade, as long as you have, say, 10, 20% of the value that they're trying to now buy, then we'll say, okay, yeah, we'll likely get it. And there's probably going to be enough of that kind of gray area that it's unlikely to be a problem. And clearinghouses determine how much cash Robinhood and other brokers have to keep on hand as just like a reserve requirement, just in case. And a big factor in this calculation is the volatility of the stocks. So if IBM stays at $100, Robinhood only needs to keep about $10 in cash at any given time to cover that trade in, and only for 2 days. They only need to keep $10 per that trade, because that's a 10% of the account. And if it's a low volatility account, could it be lower? But very roughly, they only need to have enough cash, and they only need it for a very short period of time. But because GameStop was going up so much so fast, the volatility started to get so high that the reserve requirements for clearing on Robinhood started to get so high that they literally didn't have enough money to cover these reserve requirements and cover these capital requirements that comes with clearing houses and kind of covering the proceeds of a client sell before the cash is actually received. And this was the main problem. This is why they had to restrict trading in specific securities. I don't think it's because they're kind of buddy-buddy with the hedge funds and trying to help them out. I think it was because there's this unforeseen volatility in this stock, and the trading was so high that they had to stop the buys in this account to bring back down the volatility so that they wouldn't go out of business. And so they had to do this as a business to kind of make sure they survived. But the messaging of how that works internally went out pretty poorly. And so that's why you started to get AOC and Ted Cruz agreeing on the same issue of Robinhood must be doing something illegal or some kind of market manipulation, when it's probably, no, they're actually behaving like any other normal financial institution. But also, no other institution is allowing these commission-free trades and for the trading to happen so fast in the first place. There, some are kind of, but it was almost a perfect storm of this, like you said, the confluence of events of the ease of the technology of Robinhood clashing with all the regulations in our financial industry. And kind of to survive as a business, they had to make sure that they had to stop trading in these really high volatility stocks. And everyone else took that as, oh no, this is the only reason I'm using Robinhood. The only reason I opened a Robinhood account is to buy GameStop. And if I can't buy GameStop, why do I even have a Robinhood account?
Yeah, I think Robinhood ended up on like the most unwanted app on the Google App Store with like millions of one-star reviews after they put those limits in place. It just goes to show that what a mess that this can all turn into. And I think the fallout itself has also been, it's not quite over yet, but you can kind of see rubble all over the place from, frankly, what sounds like a market disaster.
Yeah, it was funny in the moment. And in retrospect, there's definitely lessons to be learned. And I don't know if those lessons will be learned. Like, that's one of those things, like, just related to society that and technology and kind of where we're moving forward. Kind of everyone could if you had to try to apply any kind of analysis, again, everyone knew this price was unsustainable. Everyone knew it. And it still kept going up. And like everyone knew this is going to crash. Like it was the easiest predictable crash. But I remember, like, you made a comment, like, if you had tried to time that crash, you would have shorted it, and the next day it had gone up even more, and you would have gotten a margin call and you would have lost a lot of money.
I remember that day. I think it was up like 120% or something. It was in the 150s to 200s. And you don't see this too often where something is so blaringly mispriced that you know something has to break. And I remember saying that to you, Aaron. I feel like this is the best short of all time. And then I remember the following day, I'm like, well, I'm glad I didn't do anything. I really didn't plan on doing anything, but I was just reaffirming to myself the madness, because GameStop doubled from 150 to like 300 something. And I would have lost my shirt, frankly, if I had tried to short it. And it just goes to show you that probably the best advice that I could give on what to do with something like this is have fun watching it unfold and get some popcorn. And maybe that's about it. Because, you know, trying to come up with a strategy to monetize something like this is, I think, far likely to end up with disaster than actual profit.
Yeah, I think there's probably more to explore another time. But yeah, it was GameStop and Robinhood and Wall Street Bets and Reddit and this hedge fund. They're characters in this story, but it could have been any other number of things. There's more to this idea that everyone knew the price was going to crash, and it still went up. And it kind of comes back, like, same thing. I thought, if you need money in the short term, stocks are too volatile. Leave it in cash. If you need money long term, even if you owned GameStop at $5. And you bought it a year ago and did nothing, like you just bought and hold, like you're probably still better off. Like you buy stocks for a long-term strategy, but you like watch this happen in your own account. And maybe you could have gotten out at some point. It's like, okay, this is kind of gone up too much too fast, but like you buy stocks for a long-term hold. Like that's the only way to make any kind of predictions or plans or hopes. And like just what was going on in the middle of it was it was just crazy and hilarious.
Yeah. At the end of the day, so GameStop did top out around 400, but it was even reported at the end of January that Melvin Capital had already liquidated their entire short positions, and the madness continued for a few days after that. But at the end of the day, yeah, Melvin Capital did lose a couple billion dollars or so. They were down like 30% when all their shorts were liquidated. And at the end of the day, also, a lot of investors, though, in Robinhood got burnt, frankly, because people did buy this stock at 100, 200, 300, 400, and now it's trading at 60. And again, the fair value is probably closer to what it was trading before all this madness began, if you know one is being pretty fair about this. And that means you may not want to pay more than 15 or 20 bucks for something like this at the most, you know, assuming the pandemic clears and things go back to somewhat normal. So you still might stand to lose, even at today's prices, another 60, 70, 80%.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I read one story that there's a hedge fund who had kind of applied a normal fundamental analysis. Like, you know what? There's a new board member. We think they could turn things around. They bought it around $5. And again, they were just one of those normal investors. It was a hedge fund, so they had a lot of money in it. When Elon Musk tweeted out game stonks, they decided, you know what? I think this is the moment to sell. They placed an order to sell everything at the closing day. They actually ended up picking the perfect peak. That they actually picked the peak based on Elon Musk's tweets. And I think there's something to that. Something like, as soon as everyone thinks it's so crazy we're going to the moon, that's the time it goes down. I don't know this for sure. I don't know if I can ever, I don't think I can ever profit off this. But I have a few of those observations of, as soon as everyone is looking to buy stocks, that's when I get worried, I guess I'd say. It's the classic just emotional cycle of investing and this just happened to play out in the span of a couple of weeks.
Well, I'll add two kind of final points on that. One is, it's kind of ironic that the hedge fund ended up making all the money from the Robinhood investors who are supposed to take the money from the rich and give it to the poor. Oh boy. And I think your point is also right about just doing the opposite or being contrarian to what's being presented to you. I'll just throw in a Buffett quote that's kind of stood with me in general, and that's, be fearful when others are being greedy and be greedy when others are being fearful. Mm-hmm. And you saw the ultimate amount of greed flowing through with GameStop over the past month. It's a perfect time to be fearful and just not jump in on the bandwagon.
Yeah. Well, that was fun. I think there's probably a little bit more to unpack another time, but I think we got all the major players in this fun, crazy story.
Yeah, it'll be one for the history books for sure.
It's going right down there with the Dutch tulip bubble.
Yeah, and the Beanie Babies.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, thanks for teaching me about short squeezes, margin calls. I really appreciate it.
Aaron, I enjoyed doing the deep dive on this as well and just sharpening my skills on what not to do. It's always useful.
Sounds good. But,
thanks. And thanks, everybody, for listening. If you're enjoying these conversations, do spread the word. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.